Okay, we'll bring the meeting of the Legislative Electrical Energy Task Force meeting to order. We had a little problem with the tape, so we had a little delay in getting started, so everything's easy now. Folks, as you know, we had a work group working this summer to put together our report that is going to be due to the legislature in January. And today we're going to hear a little bits and pieces of that work. We're not prepared to review the entire report today, but we're going to hear some bits and pieces of that. And Mr. John Fuller is going to be presenting that with Senate Counsel. We're going to be hearing from Commissioner Leroy Popendreyer, and we're going to hear from some folks on transmission issues. So with that, if there's any other discussion on any other issues before we get started. Mr. Fuller.
Good afternoon. My name is John Fuller. I'm the way of the Senate. I'd like to make it very clear that this testimony is intended to start a discussion. There are no conclusions or specific policy recommendations. There are areas that are going to be noted where we think it will be important to have those discussions. So there is no particular policy recommendation. What we're here for today is to discuss the need for clear state energy policy and point out those areas where it may be most important. The need for a clear policy is even more important now because we're on the verge, on the cusp of making some significant investments in generation and transmission. And since those investments are significant in amount and long in duration and require private financing sources, a stable, clear policy is critical. The interim work plan of the task force that focused on wind energy development, particularly the local economic development aspect of that. There were three public meetings, two here in the Capitol and one in Pipestone, Minnesota. However, based on those meetings, there were some broader public policy issues that arose, which relate not only to wind energy, but also to other forms of electric generation, which we think are important to inform you. There will be four topics covered in today's hearing. We'll talk first about the economic development policy of the state of Minnesota with respect to wind energy and other generation. We'll talk about the role of the Public Utilities Commission in working with specific state laws and in general their duties. There'll be a discussion of transmission, which arose as an important issue during the interim work plan because it turns out that there is a shortage of transmission capacity which can stop projects in their tracks, not only wind, but others as well, and there's a heavy federal involvement in this process that I think the legislature should be aware of as they move forward with respect to any particular policy on directing generation resources. I think what people have to keep in mind, too, particularly with respect to wind, is that there are two motivating stimulus for wind development principle. And one is the various mandates in state law. A lot of the wind development has occurred directly because of various mandates. The Renewable Energy Objective, the Prairie Island. The second motivation is the federal production tax credit, which makes these projects economic. And so that when that blinks on, because it's renewed every once in a while, it's now renewed through December of 2005, contracts are signed. It's a significant factor in developing wind projects. Right. Let's turn to the issue of local economic development and wind energy projects. I think there's assumed that there's a policy that the legislature has decided that some of this should be set aside for projects for local economic development. I think, as I will show you, that may be true to a limited extent, but the way it's expressed is not in terms of economic development benefit, but a surrogate is used, small, less than 2 megawatts, or locally owned. There's no criterion statute that requires a wind energy project to be examined for its local economic benefit. And that may cause less than optimal local economic benefit, which, if you're trying to attain the maximum benefit, is not a good policy. let's step back for a second and talk about, we're talking right now about selecting generation resources. We're focusing on wind. However, this is true. We're going to need other resources going forward as well. So there's a need for a clear state policy on acquiring any generation resource. Generally, there's three aspects when you look at when you acquire and evaluate generation resources. The cost. There's a goal to get a least cost model. The reliability, which is probably the preeminent policy. It has to come to you. It has to be there. So reliability, cost, and then there's a third that you'd call cleanliness, environmental impact, renewable. That's what category. And there's a tension between some of those because sometimes the cheapest energy is not the cleanest, or the cleanest may not be the most reliable. And so now what we've done with respect to wind is maybe we've added a fourth characteristic that's not clearly defined and hasn't really been implemented, and that is the role of economic development in selecting generation resources. The interim work group investigated the economic development aspect of wind energy generation resource selection. Implicit in the investigation was an assumed state policy favoring small, locally owned wind energy facilities, particularly with respect to wind energy projects mandated by law. However, upon investigation, it appears there is no general state policy favoring locally owned small wind developments. To the limited extent there is a policy to encourage local development, it may not be expressed in the best terms because it's expressed in terms of smallness. I had distributed, I think it's there, the copies of the various wind projects that have come online. And what we discovered is that there are some small projects that are locally owned, there are some large projects that have heavy local involvement, and there are some large projects that have non-local ownership. You'll notice nowhere on that sheet is an itemization of how much local economic development benefit the project produced. I think that's because there is no hard analysis of that criteria. And if the policy of the state is to maximize local economic development benefit with respect to some of these projects, it would seem to be appropriate to have a measurement of that benefit, find the optimal sort of project that would generate it, and encourage those sorts of projects. There's a further difficulty with respect to inserting the criteria, and none of these are unmanageable, and the goal of this is to find a way to accomplish what wants to be done, is that it's very difficult. But further, it's very difficult to measure local economic benefit. So when you're trying to compare projects, even if you are making the effort, it's difficult to get hard data on how much this project is bringing to the community. A particular difficulty with this issue has been the characterization of sort of the underlying issue that we're to examine as a contest between large developers and smaller developers. This is somewhat of a mischaracterization that leads to perhaps a flawed policy of directing certain of the mandates to very small projects. It could be that the focus should be on the local nature of the project ownership rather than the size of the project. And what we found in our investigation was that larger projects do have some favorable attributes that smaller projects don't. They have economies of scale. I'm trying to think of another one now. they have a more reliability, more forecastable. So you know, if you have 102 megawatt projects scattered around the countryside, it's harder to predict what other resources you have to have online. Whereas for the reliability grid, if you have a larger project, then there's some more forecastability about the standby resources that you need. Well, why is this important? Well, we've invested a lot of money and mandated the investment of a lot of money in developing wind resources. And if we're getting less than the maximum local economic benefit, if that's a policy sustained, that's not a good situation to be in. I'll give you a few examples of state policy. The state has mandated XL to develop over 1,100 megawatts of wind alone. This is a $1 billion investment. One of the thoughts of the early Prairie Island legislation was that we would develop an indigenous manufacturing capacity for wind turbines. this has not happened. Perhaps it could have happened if we would have more thoroughly discussed the strategy of economic development and wind energy. And perhaps it can still happen. State tax policy taxes smaller wind projects at a significantly lower rate than larger wind projects. One of the local economic benefits from wind development is tax revenue. So to the extent that you encourage smaller projects, that aspect of local economic development, the tax revenue, is less. Let's examine the various mandates and see the consistency or inconsistency of the economic development policy. The Prairie Island legislation was, of course, the first one. It mandated, I believe, 225 megawatts of wind that had to be in Minnesota. So obviously you're going to get more benefit if it's in Minnesota. It mandated another 200 megawatts of wind without regard to their location. I believe they've been built in Minnesota. There's a further 400 megawatts of wind that's required under least cost planning model under the Prairie Island law. That was not limited in size, ownership, or location. In 2003, the legislature required the Renewable Development Fund to invest up to $6 million, $4.5 million for wind until 2018, in wind energy development. Those were subject to the restrictions in the Renewable Energy Production Incentive Law, which favors small, locally owned projects. The Renewable Energy Objective Law passed in 2001 had no general provision relating to project site or ownership for wind energy generation or other renewable facilities. So no mention whatsoever. It was amended in 2003 to require an additional 300 megawatts of wind from Xcel. 100 of those megawatts had to be 2 megawatts of wind. So again, very specific direction. I think that the assumption was that 100 megawatts, making it 2 megawatts, would most benefit the local folks. But there's no convincing evidence that it should have been rather 125 of 3 megawatts or 75 megawatts of 4 megawatts. We get very specific, trying to, I think, to derive the most local economic benefit, particularly for local landowners. However, there's no evidence that using that surrogate criteria will generate the most benefit. Perhaps it may do that. But we have no evidence that 25 megawatt projects would have been better. So we're being very specific and limiting in what can be built to achieve this goal of local economic development without clearly understanding what is the optimal project that would give us that maximum local economic development benefit.
Mr. Fuller, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fuller, when you say that there aren't any specific criteria that can measure the economic development impact, how is the criteria different that you measure small wind by than you measure any other small business by and the economic development impact that has on a rural community?
Senator Cooper, I think the important point would be that a couple things. One is we're mandating these things, and we're mandating them with the thought, I think, in a lot of people's minds who are sponsoring the smaller projects, that will generate the most local economic benefit. It may do that. It may not. And I think what I'm saying is we should have a discussion. If that is a goal, to derive the most economic benefit as possible from wind projects, that we devise some measuring tools and use some comparisons when selecting projects, so that we have some confidence that we have maximized the economic benefit from a state-required activity. So I don't know if that directly answers your question. How is it different? I don't think it is any different, except that you have, when you look at the studies, I mean, one of the principal gains is tax revenue. There's the construction aspect of it, and you'll find there's many studies that look at projects. Concrete's a lot of it, for instance. Well, if you don't have a concrete factory there and they ship it in from Fargo to southwestern Minnesota, you don't get that benefit. If you need to hire a crane to erect, which is a big cost of the project, you have one tower, if that feeds in the cost base of that project, that's a more significant factor whether you could spread it across 10. And so what I'm suggesting is we know that there are positive attributes to projects that aren't small. That, of course, make them cheaper and the ratepayers pay less. if those same projects can also generate local benefits as good as or greater, then it would seem to be reasonable to look at that sort of project as a project we would use to drive local economic benefit.
Well, just to follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fuller. It does seem to me that there have been other studies that have been done that look at the economic impact of something on an area where a larger number of smaller producers really contribute more to local economies than one larger producer would. And so from the standpoint of the health of rural communities, particularly, I guess I'm a rural legislator, so from the standpoint of rural communities, it would seem to me that it would be extremely beneficial for those communities to have larger numbers of smaller producers rather than smaller numbers of larger ones, if you follow what I mean.
Senator Kluber, that's the discussion I think we should have. You have the Trimont project in southern Minnesota, which is a large project, and it was started out as a locally owned project. It continues to locally develop. I believe it's about 100 megawatts. And those folks thought they'd get a lot of benefit from it, and I think they will. And then it also has these other attributes that has economies of scale. It's a large farm, so that it's more forecastable for the system and grid reliability, and it generates more tax revenue. So, like I said, you could be right. This is the result of the interim activity, looking at things and saying, maybe we haven't optimized the goal of local benefit. And I think that discussion has not been had within the legislature,
okay.
And that might be appropriate.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fuller, when you started your speech out today, you said there's four parts to this discussion. And you said, number one, economic development policy. Number two, the role of the PUC. Number three, discussion of transmission issues. And you never said number four. And I couldn't tell for sure. I couldn't tell what four was based on what happened after you said three.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deal, number four will be just a discussion of what the task force wants to do. Going forward.
Okay.
Because I think we're hopeful that we're going to introduce some issues that provoke interest, such as this issue of if we're mandating wind projects and one of the goals is to maximize economic development, then we develop a very focused economic development strategy that gets the most economic development from those projects.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, members, if you can hold your questions until Mr. Fuller gets done with his presentation, then we'll take some other questions. Mr. Fuller?
Okay. Just to step back for a second, you may recall the Mesaba project came along. I think one of the arguments for it was economic development, that was going to provide an economic development tool for a distressed area of the state. And I think so there's a larger issue here. It's not just wind. Because we are going to need in the near future, 5-10 years, some baseload capacity. And if economic development is going to be a consideration in those decisions, as they were perhaps in Mesaba and certainly in wind energy, it should be clearly articulated so that those folks who are proposing projects and bidding on projects know what the rules of the game are. Once you decide, if you do, and I think that economic development benefit is a factor, then it has to be fitted into those three criteria I talked about before. Because I don't think anybody's suggesting you do local economic development at any cost, that rates can go up to 20 times what they are. So the factors of cost, reliability, and cleanliness are still there. And economic development, which may fit under cost, or maybe it's an entirely new category that we're saying, hey, let's build some plans here. Let's get the payroll here. Let's get the tax base here. I don't know. That's a discussion that has to be had because we're going to be acquiring some assets and we need a clear policy. So I have something I call recommendations, but they're not really recommendations. I don't think to articulate a clear policy regarding local economic benefit, it's necessary to describe and understand the economic benefits that can be attributed to a project. You have to have some way of looking at and understanding what you're getting or what you're paying for, which may be higher rates, may not be. This is not an exact science, though. One of the reasons, Senator Kluber, that I'm not comfortable with telling you small or big or good is a lot of this information is proprietary. When you go out and ask them, what are you getting or what did you pay, they won't tell you for their own good reasons. So it's very hard to know what's happening with respect to local benefit, at least on that score. We need to get that information, I think, at least to some extent. So the task force may wish to explore and perhaps fund research in this area. You have a funding capacity, I think, of $250,000. Perhaps somebody should look at that. Moving forward, we're probably going to do more wind. If it is a policy to achieve the maximum local benefits from it, it would probably be wise to know how to measure them and how to compare them and what they are. And I think we have somewhat of a handle on it, but I don't think we have a complete handle. Once a clear policy based on the measurement, the metric for economic benefit is developed, and as I said, it must be fit into these other elements. You know, if we find out that this project has twice as much benefit here, but it costs three times as much, what's the Public Utilities Commission to do? I mean, they need some guidance if they're involved. So I think the interim work plan may have somewhat put the cart ahead of the horse, because it sort of asks, how can we encourage local development? How can we get them more involved? And I think the larger question is, involved in what? Investing in what? What will get them the most return from these wind mandates? And like I say, there's no decision involved. This is just a discussion I think would be helpful, because it's a lot of money. It's a great benefit to some of the areas of the state, and could be very good for our electrical grid. And again, one has to keep in mind there are two driving forces behind wind development. I think it's, one is the mandates. We've told them they have to do it. And then they'd rather do it when these production tax credits are out. They're incredibly significant. Once Congress passed the extension of the credits, a lot of deals were signed. So that concludes, again, the disclaimers. Those are just my perceptions, our perceptions from the summer activity. They're not recommendations for any course of action, rather a suggestion that discussions on this issue would be beneficial, I think.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Fuller? Any further questions? Representative Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fuller. Aren't most of the rates public in that PUC has some oversight and approval of rates and contracts, especially if they're over 12 megawatts?
Mr. Pauling?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe rates are in fact public, yes.
What were you saying should be this possible research project or study for us to put together? Weren't you saying that the rates differ and we aren't real sure on who's getting paid what and how much are they paying for larger projects or smaller projects?
Mr. Pauling?
I didn't follow that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Westman, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. What I meant to say was that the amount of local benefit is not clear from projects. And one of the reasons that is, and the reason I say this, I asked people for what the local benefits were and what people got, and I didn't get that information. Maybe I didn't ask hard enough, but I asked. So that's what I was referring to, that, again, under the assumption that we do want local benefits from these wind projects, we want to maximize them. And so to develop a policy that maximizes them, you should have in hand information about the quantity of benefits from various projects. And then you can make a judgment about what attributes of those projects contributed to their benefit to the local community, and make good judgments about what, since we have been in the business of mandating projects, we would have a better handle on which of those would deliver the goods on providing local economic benefit.
Representative Genius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like your saying that developers should know the rules of the game, and that's what you're trying to achieve here. But we, in knowing the rules of the game, we also need to know the amount of local cost. We talked about the amount of local gain, and you listed the three costs of rate, reliability, and cleanliness. But under the cleanliness, I don't understand what you mean. And let me just give you an example of what I hope you mean. We know that the coal-fired plant in the district that Representative Kornstein and I come from costs us in health care costs between $66 and something over $100 million a year. When you look at the cost side, are you being very specific in health care costs so we have some good comparison.
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, what I was referring to was what was ever in the statute, which now includes externalities. I think my thinking would be that you have these three variables, basically, cost, reliability, cleanliness. If it was cheap and reliable and clean, it's a no-brainer. I mean, you go for the clean, the cheap and reliable. If it was clean, significantly more costly, same reliability, then we get into the discussion you just had, and I think people fall on either side of that line. And under our state law, we do look at environmental externalities, the pollution cost, which is a surrogate for health costs, I think, but not totally equivalent, of course, at all. So that's what when I say cost, I say whatever you want it to be. If there's a debate on it, you know, I'm not here to say what cost it should be, because that's a subject that's under debate. Some folks think it should include what you say, and it should be, you know, coal should have a huge negative cost because of those issues. Some don't feel as strongly on it.
Representative Wagenius.
Just as a follow-up, I mean, as a practical matter, we're getting into some pretty fine lines with regard to wind development, and maybe that's a good idea, but when we have these broad, huge cost issues, it seems to me we can't just say that one thing is a surrogate for another, that we have to be pretty precise, because we can be pretty precise about health care costs, particularly now that the governor is recognizing that we have to do something about the health care costs that are rising so fast in Minnesota. So I don't want us to spend all of our time on something that's fairly small and tight and miss something that's big and costly. That's my concern here, just listening to this debate.
Senator Cooley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fuller, I just wanted to be clear. You know, one of the criteria that I've seen used with some regularity in terms of understanding local economic development impact is the times a dollar turns over in a community, but it's those dollar figures that you have unavailable to you. Is that correct?
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cooley, I have read studies that analyze some of the Minnesota projects. I haven't seen any that have analyzed all of them, and they have used that in addition to other measurements for local economic benefit. There's the construction phase, uh-huh. There's the operation phase, there's the tax phase, and they've looked at some of it. And they've used models mostly, though. I mean, they model it, and there's some assumptions in those models. I'm not sure how many. Okay. I just don't know. I don't remember when they want to look at receipts. You know, they'd be actually itemize it and verify it, and to that extent, I think they model.
Anyone else? Further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Fuller. Very good job. Mr. Fuller?
I'm going to introduce the next speaker.
Okay.
And I think it segues very well from Representative McKinney's point about specificity and not seeing the big picture, because some issues have arisen about that. The Public Utilities Commission has a key role in the shaping and implementation of state energy policy. The Commission has an expert staff and a formal process to decide on issues such as certificate of need for power plants. The goal of this segment of the agenda is to initiate discussion about ways for the legislature and the Commission to work together to develop and implement clear energy policy. And that's the theme, clear energy policy. Since 1994, the legislature has frequently engaged in making specific policy, not general policy like cheap, reliable, but 200 megawatts of wind with respect to electric energy. The specific policies include storage of nuclear waste, mandating specific biomass generation, providing for a specific target for renewable energy, specific wind mandates, and specific mention of certain projects. These mandates occur in the context of a long-range planning process. There's a lot of other stuff going on. And sometimes they don't fit in neatly to what's going on, and maybe they could have. In other words, they could have been done better. The focus on energy policy now is also becoming more than just state. It's becoming regional and national. We have national markets, so transmission is being built not for negative load, but to move power across the state. That's a new world, and our statutes haven't been changed for a while. These specific mandates have led to a series of uncertainties principally because they are so specific. And like I said, don't fit neatly within some of the general policy guidelines. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. We've had some conflict. The Renewable Energy Objective Law required extensive hearings this last spring, a 25-30-page order. It's now in court. And one of the key provisions is being challenged, and depending on how it's resolved, will have a significant impact on the renewable energy obligation of utilities. I think we should be aware of that. We should have a process where we are informed of what's going on so that we can respond to that. The Commission has done a good job in trying to ascertain legislative intent in administering these specific laws and the general laws. But it's been a difficult task, and hopefully we can find a way that we can make that task easier by cooperating with each other in maybe just informal ways. Two of the commissioners are here today to testify. They're Chair Kopendreyer and Commissioner Rieger. They are somewhat constrained in their testimony. They're not free to comment about specific cases necessarily, but they are free to discuss their duties and express opinions and how they can work with the legislature to make and implement clear energy policy that's coordinated with other jurisdictional authorities and with other policies and serves the public and the industry. So I would introduce Commissioner Kopendreyer and Commissioner Rita, and thank them for coming.
Sure, thanks. Linda. Thank you.
Commissioners, welcome to the task force.
Thank you.
Mr. Rhea and I don't have a formal presentation. I've got some notes while I'm listening to the report. And we welcome the discussion on the issue of how we can work on these issues together. I'm the chair of the commission, but the responsibility of the chair is to convene the meeting, and after that we're co-equal. So there's a couple of thoughts that maybe stimulate some discussion. The Public Utilities Commission has in recent times seen it a greater and greater need to become involved in regional and national issues as a historic community. For example, our transmission grid, as you well know from the blackout a year and a half ago, is not local, it's regional. Whether we like it or not, it's regional. And so we've been involved in the transmission issue quite a bit, in that we have a seat on the organization of MISO states, which is an advisory capacity to MISO, which is the Mid-American Independent System Operator, which will be the operator of the grid in Minnesota and other Midwest states. And we have a seat on the advisory council of that organization. In doing that, it becomes increasingly evident to us that energy issues, as they're discussed in the legislature, aren't as local as we'd like to believe. They're really regional. And energy policy, the need for good energy policy because of the huge increase in use of energy around the world is becoming more and more important. So another issue that the commission is involved in is I also have a seat on the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition to move the nuclear waste out of Minnesota into Yucca Mountain. And that effort is moving forward. And it's no secret, just as a personal comment, it's no secret that when I was in the legislature and then went to the commission, that I wasn't really a fan of some of the environmental efforts that were being pushed. And when I got on the commission, I wasn't really a fan of wind energy. But it has become really apparent to me that if we're going to have, we talk about economic development, if we're going to have a good economic development policy, we need a good energy policy. And a good energy policy
isn't wind. It isn't nuclear. It isn't coal. It isn't gas. It isn't other renewables. It's all of them. The use, like I said, the use of energy in our nation increasing and around the world increasing. The message that we've heard when we go to national meetings all the time from the experts in all of these fields is, folks, we got to recognize that we need them all. We need wind. We need other renewables. We need coal. We need nuclear. We need gas. And we need efficient use of all of them. In other words, conservation. We need them all. And a good, coherent policy of how these can all work together to afford us the most reliable and economically affordable energy is the best economic policy we can have. So, like Mr. Ford was alluding to, a good economic policy, when you take one piece of the energy and put it here, or divide it up like this, may be good for one area, but as a state, the best economic policy we can have is a good energy policy for the whole state. We on the commission get to see the proprietary information. And we get to see the costs of the various projects that are proposed to fill some demand. And the cost differences are, in some cases, startling. And we have to deal with that within the parameters that the legislature gives us. So it's our hope to be able to have somewhat of a dialogue to say, here's how what's being proposed, as we see it, fits into a broader energy policy for the state. Because you really have, when you're talking about an economic policy, you got a couple of major inputs. You got a tax policy, you got a labor issue, and then you got energy inputs. And they're somewhat co-equal. We can have a good tax policy, lots of labor, and high cost energy, and we won't have a good economic environment in our state. So we have to work within the parameters that we're given, and we're willing to do that. But Mr. Fuller was hit more buttons than you probably realize in how sometimes we look at some of the mandates and some of the statutes, and we say, how in the world can we use this and work within this to benefit the consumer? Because we stand between the energy companies, basically, and the energy policy that comes out of the legislature and the consumer to try to make sense of that, put them all together, and get the best possible, reliable, affordable energy that we can to the consumer. And that's just kind of an overview, and I'll stop. And
thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the task force, it's really a pleasure to be here and speak with you this afternoon. I've been on the Public Utilities Commission for about 3.5 years now, and it's an ever-changing and incredible learning experience for me, having come from being an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearing for many years, where as an ALJ you delve into one case and you understand it, and now as a Public Utilities Commission to look at the broad scope of issues and the interplay of those issues and policies and the impact that commissioners make in making decisions. And our role is primarily one of quasi-adjudicatory issues, where issues come before us and we have to look at the record and make a judgment, not unlike what I did as an administrative law judge. But also, within the scope of those decisions that we make, we are also not only determining the facts and making a decision on the basis of the record, but we're setting policy. We're interpreting the policies that the legislature gives us in the laws, but by doing that, we are determining that more of the details, if you will, and implementing your broad policy. And stakeholders really pay attention to that. And we sometimes walk a tightrope of trying to meet the interests of all the stakeholders that appear in front of us by also going forward and making the decisions. Once in a while we land in court because one stakeholder or another is not going to like the decisions that we make, and then the courts ultimately decide those issues. But one reason, as I understand, why we've been asked to be here today is how can we develop an interrelationship, better communication with the lawmakers, with the legislature. And I agree with most everything that Sheriff Obedar has said. Our commission right now works very collaboratively. And we have a good working relationship among the five commissioners. We have a very strong commissioners group, and we work well together. We don't always agree on all the issues, but we understand where we're coming from. And that's the kind of relationship that I would like to see with the legislature. So in other words, when you might propose a certain legislation that would impact what we do on the Public Utilities Commission, it might be nice if that legislation, the proposed language, is perhaps passed in front of us try to influence your ultimate decision, but to perhaps point out to you things that we might find problematic when we are asked to implement it. And that type of communication, I think, would be very helpful. The buck stops with you guys in terms of making the ultimate decision, but certainly our input might be helpful to you in trying to decide how you might want to present the legislation that would come forward. I really think what's lacking here, though, in the state of Minnesota, and Chair Kovner has touched upon this, is the lack of an integrated energy policy for the state of Minnesota. I really think that we need an integrated energy policy that sets forth public policy for future energy production, end use efficiencies, economic development, reliability, cost, new technology, research and development, some policy that perhaps prioritizes these issues, that recognizes if there is a need for new generation in the state of Minnesota, but we have to also consider environmental impacts, that perhaps it might be better to grab at the low-hanging fruit, if you will, and try end-use efficiency and energy efficiency and conservation before that might not necessarily prevent the need for new generation, but perhaps delay a new generation. It's not obviously the complete answer, but you could prioritize what types of issues are important within the scope of the need to serve the energy needs of our public going forward in the future, doing it a short time, mid-term, and long-term, a portfolio, if you will, of energy issues that the legislature decides what the priorities are for purposes of Minnesota going forward in the future. And I think that I came aboard the Public Utilities Commission with a goal towards collaboration with people as opposed to a top-down type of decision-making, that I think the best decisions are those that are made collaboratively with stakeholders. And so this task force is, I think, an excellent place to begin that collaboration with a number of different groups, and I know you've spent a lot of time doing that. But I think that energy policy going forward in the future
not only come from the legislature, but the participation from our Department of Commerce that helps set energy policy, the Public Utilities Commission that has to interpret that energy policy and implement that energy policy, and other stakeholders, the utilities, the environmental groups, the consumer advocates, and everyone that plays a part in energy in the state of Minnesota. I just came back, and I agree with Leroy, Commissioner Kopitar, that these issues really are now more regional and national in scope than ever before. We can't talk about transmission siting anymore without looking at the regional interrelationship of that transmission, or the national relationship of that transmission, if you will. We do have, as Commissioner Goldberger has said, these regional organizations already in place to begin that communication between the states, among the states, to determine how best to address transmission constraints and transmission bottlenecks. There has been, a clear statement from this legislature about the desirability, let's say, of renewable energy. And that also transcends political boundaries. We are working on a regional effort to track renewables in the upper Midwest. And other regions of the country are also developing tracking mechanisms so that we can determine that renewables are not being double counted and they're being developed to the full extent of their supposed to be developed. We sit on national organizations of the Mid-America Regulatory Conference that has the 15 different states in the region that talk about energy policy on a regional basis. Our National Association of Regulatory Commissioners constantly talks about energy policy going forward in the future. As I said, I just got back from a national meeting of the Electric Power Research Institute that is struggling with the issue of research and development for new technologies. So, for example, we can answer the question of what you do when wind is only blowing intermittently, and how do we how do we develop storage for wind so that it becomes more cost-effective anymore and can fit better into a portfolio of energy options. So I really think that, and economic development, I really believe that a lot of these issues, that's an appropriate goal in economic development for the state of Minnesota as well. I guess I'm here to say that I'm very willing, and I think my fellow commissioners and our staff are very willing to communicate and to collaborate and to offer whatever advice or assistance that we can to you. But I think we urge that a comprehensive, integrated energy policy is really necessary, and that it not be done in a vacuum, that it includes stakeholders and it take into consideration regional and national issues.
Thank you, commissioners. Questions? Representative Warrenstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, commission members, for your testimony. I have a question for Mr. Kopenreier. You had mentioned there's some kind of a process or state process related to Yucca Mountain. I hadn't heard about that. What exactly is the process moving forward related to that? Is it a transportation planning, or what is the DEC doing on that exactly?
Mr. Kopenreier.
Thank you, Representative. It isn't a particular one-state effort. The Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition is a group of some 26 states. The group of the waste is 32 states, but it's a group of some 26 states right now that is working to keep the issue alive in front of Congress for ongoing funding. Last year, of course, we had to have a vote in the Senate to override the state of Nevada, and that was accomplished, and now the licensing process is moving forward. So those of us from the states who have this nuclear waste, we're paying into that fund. We've paid in over $20 billion with the interest. It's over $20 billion that the states have paid in. And what we're saying is, look, Congress, you got our money. Now take our waste like you promised so that we can continue to run these plants and not have the state, not have the waste piling up at transportation. And that's the effort that we keep in front of Congress on a week-by-week basis, especially budget crunch time.
So a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So there isn't any, this is all part of that national consortium, there isn't any Minnesota-specific planning going on at this point, is that correct? In terms of, like, transportation routes or emergency response or anything like that.
That is going on. There was a hearing in St. Paul just a couple of months ago on the transportation issue and how transportation would affect the state of Minnesota and the Department of Public Safety and other entities were involved in that discussion. The transportation issue is alive and being discussed, but we've got to have Yucca Mountain ready for the fuel before the transportation takes place, so there's kind of a prioritizing of a limited dollars right now that the Congress can tell.
Senator Anson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you both for your comments as well. Commissioner Reha, you talked about the need for an integrated energy policy for Minnesota, and I think that's a good idea. We do have a statute that is kind of, I see as a very abbreviated statement of our energy policy where it sets forth the order of priority in which new kinds of energy production or electricity production should be approved, starting with efficiency and then going to wind and solar and then the most environmentally benign sources on down the road. And so it sets forth, you know, in for planning purposes, we're supposed to go in this order and try the preferences for those sources that have the least negative impacts. And so I guess what I'm curious about is what you mean when you say energy policy, because I guess you're saying that's not quite enough, having just a statute that lists things in order of preference. And along the same lines, maybe you could just comment about how you see your role as public utility commissioners. I mean, you're not quite judges. You're sort of quasi-judicial, I'm not sure what else. But, I mean, if we had what form would we have to have an energy policy that you could respond to in your decision-making? Would it have to be something in statute, or if we all got together and wrote a nice document that said this is what we all agree is our energy policy, would you be able to refer to that in making your decisions, or is that sort of too informal? So I'm just curious how that would affect your decision-making process.
Senator Reha. Those are excellent questions, Mr. Chair. I guess as part of what might be lacking in what I see as an integrated energy policy is a discussion of for example, whether or not we need to encourage local development. Mm-hmm. That should be in that particular policy as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's good the way it's set out in terms of prioritizing the energy sources, but mm-hmm. I think we need to rethink the energy policy based on local needs, regional needs, and national needs. I think it needs to encompass issues related, maybe more clarifying issues related to cost. So, for example, mm-hmm. There's a lack of long-term investment in energy production because the utilities are concerned about being able to improve their investment. So when we see legislation like the MERC project, for example, mm-hmm. that was very good because it told the commission that we could vary the issue of lease cost and rate recovery and the normal rate proceeding, and that we could look at other come to the conclusion that this was good for Minnesota and that this should be approved for the utility company to be able to recoup the costs on an ongoing basis. So that kind of legislation that provides that specificity more, that helps guide us in terms of implementing policies, I think is helpful. So your question of our role and whether you need a detailed legislation on that, that's a difficult one. But I know our Department of Commerce assists in developing energy policy, and with them and with other stakeholders, we could certainly attempt to attempt to propose an integrated energy policy, and then the legislature could participate in that or see fit, if they see fit, to adopt that as something going forward. That's just an idea. I can't tell you how to legislate, but I really think that stakeholders need to come together and try to develop a long-range integrated energy policy that takes a look at goals of economic development, reliability, cost, energy production, end use efficiency, renewable energy, and all of those things, and just provide guidance to the regulators to try to do that.
If I might add, just a thought that came to mind. The legislature, as I remember it anyway, tries not to, let's just take transportation policy. The legislature tries not to say, let's add a lane to the road in front of Senator Metzen's house so that he can get out faster. The legislature appropriates transportation funds, gives broad policy direction, and then lets the people that are studying the issue of transportation try to allocate those dollars. As a Public Utilities Commission, one of the things that I would say in general, you can take issue with it, but set broad goals for energy policy for the state, but the specifics of this should be here and this should be here and we want this in this area because really don't lend themselves to good energy policy. And we have the opportunity to hear the testimony, to listen to the participants, and to try to put together and meet those goals that the legislature would set as broad parameters. But too much specificity without all that input doesn't make for good policy, just like it wouldn't make for good transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess sort of a related question, and I don't know if you can even answer this, so I'll preface it by saying I want to ask about the renewable energy objective, and if that's in litigation, does that mean you can't even talk about it?
One element is in litigation of it, and we don't know a lot about that at this particular point, but we can talk about what's in our orders.
Okay.
If the former judge says we can talk about it,
I'll trust that.
What we can talk about.
And I guess what I understand of the decision is very frustrating as a legislator, because I think that you'd probably get, if you ask all the legislators what we meant when we passed that renewable energy objective or the requirement for XL, we wanted to stimulate more wind development, possibly biomass development, development of Minnesota's homegrown energy sources. And as I understand it, the decision allows the utilities instead to count existing old projects from other states that aren't wind. So it meets none of those criteria. It's not new development, it's not wind, and it's not even in Minnesota. And I think that's what we all meant when we passed that law. And so I don't know, where did we sort of fail? Where do we have this failure to communicate? Am I misunderstanding the decision, or is there a problem in our legislative intent being translated into your reading of the statutes? I'm not sure.
Any comments, commissioners?
What happened?
Well, I got the feeling that what you may have meant
Thank you.
You wanted to count Wisconsin projects.
What we ought to do with it. fairly wasn't real clear. And what we tried to do is take that and say, how can we work with the industry to meet this general mandate? And how can we be fair to the consumer and to the industry so that they can deliver a product to the consumer and still stay within that mandate? Because the discussion always is, if you get too specific about what you have to do tomorrow and don't take into consideration what you did yesterday, nothing's going to happen today. We want to encourage industry to do something today to meet those goals that you have. And if you're going to be too specific tomorrow and not include what's done today, you're not going to have anything happen today. Nothing's going to be invested.
I think this was a very difficult issue that the commission looked at, and it had to do, we did do some statutory construction to come to the conclusion that we did, and the conclusion was that the statute specifically excluded two categories of pre-existing generation from counting for the renewable energy objective, and they were delineated in the statute. It was generation mandated by Chapter 641, of laws of 1994, and the second was generation from a refuse-derived fuel facility with a power sales agreement in effect of May 29, 2003. So we felt that the statute did not prevent us from counting generation that was produced out of the state of Minnesota as long as it was used to serve Minnesota. And I think part of the discussion that we had, and Stat, stop me if I'm going too far on what I should be talking about here, but I think what we were thinking when we were looking at that is that a lot of the utility companies now, and this is where we're getting on this regional and national scope, the utility companies they're not only within the borders of Minnesota, they're systems. And they serve not only Minnesota, and they serve Wisconsin, and they serve Dakotas, and so, and decisions where to build is not necessarily Minnesota, that serves Minnesota customers. So, so I think the thinking, I voted in favor of that, but I think I was reluctantly voted in favor of that the issue of outside Minnesota and inside Minnesota and old and new issues. But I think that was the thinking of the commission in interpreting the statute. And that's the conclusion that we came to. And that's what was reflected in our board. So I think if that wasn't the legislative intent, then you might want to take a look at
Mr. Chair, just very briefly, right, follow up. I think judging by the comment from across the table, maybe we should talk about the House and the Senate working together to clarify our legislative intent so that the PUC can better determine what that means.
We'll stay out of that one.
Yeah, that's wise.
Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, this sparks some memory out of the cobwebs in my mind, and I remember visiting with Chair Copendreyer probably a year ago and him saying, what in the heck did you guys mean? We're not sure. And then if you go back a year and a half before that, I always found it interesting because I had actually worked with staff and some House members to add some great specificity to the renewable energy objectives, which the Senate rejected at that time because they said it's getting too specific and let the PUC figure it out. And so I am someone who thinks we ought to be a little more specific when we send laws out of here. It's just kind of an ironic twist to the path that's come out here.
I thought when I was in the House with some of these folks that when we wrote statutes, we were very, very clear. And then I went to the PUC and I had an attorney on this side and an attorney on this side explaining that statute, and I didn't even know anymore what we wrote.
Well, Mr. Chair, not to monopolize this, but maybe this does point to go back to the point that Commissioner Rehan made, that perhaps we do need a unified policy, and we need to have a discussion about whether it is our intention to try to actually stimulate wind development in the state of Minnesota or not, because apparently the statute isn't clear, according to our experts here who are charged with interpreting it. And if it's not, we need to make it clearer.
But, Mr. Chair, I would encourage you when you're doing that to recognize that energy isn't the state of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota is highly dependent for its energy on what's done in other states. And the companies are regional in nature. So if we're looking at the benefit to the consumer, which drives the economy, then we have to be careful about being too specific.
Sounds like a
mistake. And I just might add an issue. I do think the REO does stimulate renewables in the state of Minnesota. And I think that some of the policies that through our orders that the commission has developed has also stimulated and encouraged that. And I know that when we looked at the transmission from southwest Minnesota to the load center. I think we specifically took into consideration issues like rural economic development, to those issues. So it's really, a real difficult job. As commission sometimes is when we have all the stakeholders come in front of us from all directions, and they're all very smart, and they all make very good ideas. And to balance that policy, but still feeling that you're making good policy going forward by interpreting your policies, I think we really try to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioners. Commissioner Rehan and Chairman Copendreyer, thank you for your testimony and coming in today.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator O'Brien.
Chairman, I just want to make a comment to Representative Hornstein's interest in transportation, because there's been an ongoing number of entities around the country that have been studying the transportation of the spent fuel for well over a decade. And John Kerr with the department here has been involved in that. And I have the last couple of years. In the Midwest, it's the Midwestern Legislative Conference of CSG. In the West, it's the Western Governors Association. And so they've been the ones who've been working with DOE and other organizations and locally all the states to develop all the protocols and decide, you know, what it is for rail and what it is for highway. You know, we're not a corridor state, so we're not going to have to probably worry about a lot of other shipments coming through here other than what we have leaving, if and when the federal government actually decides they don't want to be in violation of the court order from 1998 to take the spent fuel. But so that's being worked on, and I guess John Kerr, if anybody wants to talk about that issue, would be somebody who's very knowledgeable in Minnesota.
It'll happen. It's going to move.
Thank you, Senator Arata. Thank you, Commissioners. Okay. We're going to hear now on some transmission issues. And to start off the discussion, we're going to hear from Pulse Research, Bob Ela.
Is there a Democrat?
Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Ela. Over the past 6 months, the work group has heard from a wide variety of people that have interest in the development of wind in Minnesota. Utilities, small and large wind developers, state policy analysts from the private sector, energy and environmental public interest representatives. And one thing they all agreed upon, and maybe it was the only thing that such a wide diversity of opinion could agree upon, is the need for greater transmission capacity in Minnesota if wind is to succeed here. We heard that the four transmission lines that are going to be built in southwestern Minnesota to take wind energy from Buffalo Ridge are more or less fully subscribed right now, before they're even built. We heard that Xcel Energy, on occasion, has been paying producers for wind that, because of transmission capacity problems, it can't send anywhere, essentially wasting. This capacity shortage affects other sources of energy as well, and given the projections for Minnesota's utilities of a need for developing about 4,000 megawatts of baseload intermediate capacity over the next 10 years. I think we're going to be hearing a lot about that at the legislature. But adequate transmission resources are particularly important for wind, not the least of which reason is that wind is typically located far from where large numbers of consumers are and has to be transported to them to use. But another reason concerns, like I said, call timing. A transmission bottleneck negates one of wind's principal advantages over conventional sources of electric generation, and that's the ability to build projects quickly. 18 months to a two-year time frame is not unusual. The problem is that transmission projects often take 6 or 7 years or longer to build. So unless transmission projects are planned in advance of additional wind generation, that generation is going to have trouble getting to market. So timing is a crucial element. Generation and transmission have to be looked at in tandem. But what we've got is a classic chicken and egg problem. Developers can't build wind turbines and then sit around for a couple of years while transmission is being planned and built. On the other hand, developers of transmission have to have enough wind generation in place to make building that transmission economically viable. Okay. And the process is not made any easier by the characteristics of wind and a lot of other renewable energies. That we've got small projects. We don't know exactly when or where wind generation is going to be developed or by whom. That complicates the entire situation. What I'd like to do today is describe kind of how this system came about, and maybe if we understand the forces that produce the situation, we can get a better sense of what, how much freedom the legislature might have to affect it in one way or another. A lot of people, many of whom are in this room, have made Minnesota a national leader in wind development over the past several years. But unless the state becomes as adept at figuring out how to get that wind to market as it was in developing the wind in the first place, that leadership may be at risk. The problem is not exclusive to Minnesota. Nationally, since the 1970s, electricity demand has been running at twice the rate of building new transmission lines. In Minnesota, the last transmission line built before these four in the Southwest that I talked about earlier was in 1979, 25 years ago. And how we bridged that quarter century gap was through a combination of conservation, the deployment of natural gas peaking plants, and purchases from the grid. So the question, why are so few transmission lines being built? Well, local opposition to power lines is one reason. We're certainly familiar with that in Minnesota from 25 years ago. But another significant reason is regulatory uncertainty. Uncertainty as to who will own and operate the transmission system, and more particularly, who will pay for those transmission additions and improvements to the grid. This was not a problem when utilities owned both generating plants and transmission lines to bring that power to customers. New transmission was financed by the utility prior to generation, up front. The timing was coordinated because it was the same body that was handling both ends. It was assumed that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission would affirm that the project benefited ratepayers and increased grid reliability. Transmission investment was repaid in the electricity rates from the electricity being generated, usually over a period of 5 years. This is the system that governed the expansion of the electrical grid during the 20th century. But that model of utility finance no longer operates. The link between generation and transmission has been cut. What changed? Electricity restructuring, the move towards a more market-based system of providing our electrical services, has transformed this system. The federal government has pushed utilities to separate their transmission and their generation operations. In 1999, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission required utilities to transfer operational control of transmission to regional transmission organizations, such as MISO, the Midwest Independent Systems Operator. The Minnesota utilities have done so. In order to create a freely flowing market in wholesale electricity, all transmission lines are now essentially common carriers with access equally available to all generators. The utility which owns its own transmission can't even favor that transmission under such a system. That also means the transmission can't be developed specifically for wind or for coal, but must be open to all generators. In short, this is not your father's electricity grid. With respect to transmission, the thought behind this market model was this. Since transmission represents a fairly small proportion of overall retail costs, less than 10%, paying for the additional transmission lines to access the lower cost resources will still result in net benefits to ratepayers in terms of lower prices. In fact, MISO's first five-year transmission plan, which was issued in, June of 2003, confirmed this hypothesis. They looked at a high wind scenario, essentially developing 10,000 megawatts of wind throughout the Midwest, and concluded that access to lower cost wind offset the cost of the additional transmission lines that would be needed to bring that wind to market, resulting in lower overall energy cost to consumers. But that confirmed hypothesis still doesn't tell us who is going to make the transmission investment. That's the question the new system hasn't answered yet. Who pays for constructing the transmission lines? As the U.S. Department of Energy report to Congress issued in May of this year stated, and I quote, "The question of who pays for transmission expansions will be a major barrier to large-scale exploitation of the abundant wind and coal resources in the upper Midwest. Until the question of who pays, which includes issues of cost recovery and cost allocation, is answered, there likely will be no major expansion of transmission capacity to support clean energy development in the upper Midwest," end quote. How does this new market system match up with renewable energy and wind in particular? It appears not very well. Many wind projects, as I said, are small, and so is the financial capacity of the folks who are developing them. They cannot make a substantial upfront contribution in transmission lines. So, will the utility that's buying the power step in and make the investment? Again, the characteristics of wind complicate the situation. The small size of wind projects and the fact that several projects in a given area are developed over a period of years means that the initial projects developed may not justify such a substantial investment in transmission. There's that chicken and egg problem again, which goes first. In the past, both pieces of the puzzle, generation transmission, were controlled by the same entity, so coordination was a lot easier. But now that's not the case. The new open access regime produces another obstacle to transmission investment, illustrating what economists call the free rider problem. Since capacity on the line must be open to all, where's the incentive for you to be the one that builds the line if everybody else can essentially get the same benefits that you will once it's up and running? If you build the line, you assume all the risks, but everybody else also gets a lot of benefits. As the California Public Utilities Commission stated in a December 2003 report to its legislature, the fact that some developers in a given renewable resource area would bear disproportionate financial responsibility for required transmission upgrades, while other developers would escape such costs, creates a serious obstacle to the planned development of renewable resources. Another significant source of uncertainty surrounding transmission investments is the issue of recovering those investments in retail electric rates. The major issue is how to allocate rates and benefits of transmission service when the flows over a line contain power destined for Minnesota customers, referred to as native load, and some power that's only passing through the state to go to customers in another state, wholesale electricity. How the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission will set those rates is as yet unknown, and I think that uncertainty is something that makes potential transmission investors somewhat nervous. MISO currently has a task force working to look at, determine how to allocate benefits and costs of transmission across its 14-state membership. And they will file a rate-setting protocol with the FERC, at which point Minnesota may intervene if it feels that its interests or the interests of its consumers are not served by the tariff. The FERC can, of course, accept or reject the proposed rate framework. Another factor which many have pointed to as inhibiting the speedy construction of new transmission lines is the length and complexity of the Public Utilities Commission certificate need process and the subsequent environmental review of such projects conducted by the Environmental Quality Board. This, again, is an area the legislature may want to examine to see if the timeline can be shortened. In recent years, the Minnesota legislature has recognized the import of a lot of these issues and has addressed transmission needs for renewables. In 2001 and 2002, legislation was passed allowing utilities to recover the cost of transmission for energy generated to meet the renewable energy objectives automatically without the need for a separate rate case. This reduces some of the risk and the uncertainty surrounding transmission. The Commission has established a process to review those costs that are proposed for this automatic rate recovery, and the first case, which consists of 8 Excel projects, is currently awaiting a Commission decision. In 2001, the legislature explicitly gave the Commission the authority to order public utilities to make adequate infrastructure investments in transmission facilities. MISO also has such authority, although neither organization has made use of it yet. Also in 2001, the legislature ordered utilities owning or operating transmission lines to submit a report to the PUC every 2 years identifying present and foreseeable inadequacies in the state's transmission system and alternative means to address them. This statute was amended in 2003 to include specific requirements that such reports determine necessary transmission upgrades to support development of renewable energy sources required to meet the state's renewable energy objectives. We will see when the next round of reports are filed a year from now how useful a roadmap we have. I should also mention that there are two ongoing MISO studies which are looking at developing a combination of wind and coal resources that will contribute additional information and planning regarding future transmission needs. One study is focusing on North Dakota and Minnesota, while another is encompassing parts of Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. I think the legislature will want to closely monitor all of these issues as they continue to develop. In particular, the biennial transmission reports due to be filed a year from now, given the new directive from the legislature in 2003 to report on the transmission actually needed to support the REOs, may provide a clearer look at future needs. Again, looking at what the legislature might do here, it's clear that MISO studies take place at the regional level, as Commissioner Coffin-Dreyer pointed out. And biennial transmission reports aggregate Minnesota utility perspectives on transmission for renewables. What may be a piece missing is a Minnesota-wide look at ensuring that the legislature's commitment to developing sources of renewable energy is matched by a similar commitment to make sure that those energy sources get to market. And the legislature may want to watch to make sure that that interest is being served. And if they think that more comprehensive planning needs to be done, obviously there are various ways to do that. This uncertainty that I've talked about surrounding transmission has segues well into our next speakers because they represent an organization that I think came about largely because of that uncertainty. CapEx 2020 is composed of four of the largest utilities in Minnesota. We're looking at the next 15 years for the generation and transmission, and they are going to speak next. So I'd like to welcome Rod Scheel, the Vice President of Asset Management for Otter Tail Power, and Gordon Peach, the Manager of Systems Operations for GRE. Unless there are any questions for me.
Any questions for Mr. Eloff?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in everything that Mr. Eloff. But it appears to me that the model is, and it's totally a natural model, is that everybody, the barriers are put up by not only legislators, lawmakers, let's just say lawmakers, regulators, and enforcers, but the only model that can come out of all of that is NIMBY. Everything is NIMBY. It has to be somebody else's responsibility to fill in the blank from top to bottom, from bottom to top. And it's a model that I don't know how we built so wonderfully, but we can't. How do we get ourselves out of it? And when I say not, I don't mean the build, the physical presence, but the responsibility is NIMBY. It's been designed as NIMBY.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carso, yeah, I don't know that we can blame ourselves. A lot of these decisions were made at the federal level and at the regional level. And as employees of the states, there are two things going on. The market-based nature of the whole system kind of forces you to look at the bigger picture in order to extract the economies of scale that Mr. Fuller talked about earlier. On the other hand, we all work for particular states and want to ensure the interests of our states are protected. There's a tension there that there's no solution to.
Thanks for your work.
Thank you, Mr. Eloff. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Rod Scheel with Otter Tail Power Company.
For the record, my name is Gordon Peach, Manager of System Operations for Red River Energy.
Welcome.
We have a short presentation.
All
Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure for me to be here today representing the five major transmission utilities in the state of Minnesota. And what we have been working on is what I would call a consensus vision for transmission infrastructure investments in Minnesota and the adjoining states. Some of the key points that we are currently analyzing is load growth. Cordy Peachin and a few minutes ago just quantified what we forecast that load growth to be in the next 15 years. Also, we're looking at new generation. We've talked to a lot of stakeholders that are planning or discussing different projects. We're trying to factor that into our transmission planning. We're also looking at how we can execute these plans that we're talking about. And at this point in time, the phase of our effort with CapEx 2020 is a very high-level discussion. And we don't have all the specific technical studies completed. We anticipate doing that about April of next year. We're looking at a 15-year horizon, and that's where the name 2020 comes from, 15 years hence from the year 2005. And on behalf of myself and the others, our focus is execution. We have an obligation to keep the lights on for our customers, and that's the focus of our efforts. The project sponsors are illustrated here, Great River Energy, Minnesota Power, Otter Tail Power Company, Excel Energy, and Missouri River Energy Services. Our mission, as we see it, is to create a joint vision of the required transmission infrastructure investments needed to meet the growth and demand for electricity in Minnesota and the region, and also to work to create an environment that allows these projects to be developed in a timely and efficient manner and consistent with public interest. Now, Gordy Peach will discuss some of the technical aspects or the technical scope of the investigation that we're currently engaged in. Gordy.
Thank you. The CapEx 2020 study involves two particular studies that are ongoing in parallel. One of them is just a detailed study trying to address the reliability problems in the Red River Valley that were identified in the late 1990s. Many changes were made to the transmission system to alleviate the problem, but it hasn't fully been fully addressed. We're currently in the process of doing a detailed study trying to identify those transmission facilities that are necessary to relieve that reliability constraint up in the Red River Valley. Our focus is to have a study completed in preparation for a certificate of need. The other study is a more of a visionary study or exploratory study. Its focus is on load serving in the state of Minnesota and the surrounding region. We're also concerned about the Minnesota renewable energy objective and included that in our base study analysis as well. Our focus is to identify common transmission facilities in anticipation of possible locations of generation within the state and surrounding area. The study area that we're considering encompasses the state and the parts of adjoining states. Our focus has been on identifying load within those utilities that serve within the state of Minnesota and in the adjoining states. We anticipate, based on information we've received from our resource planning people, that within the next 15 years, an additional 6,300 megawatts of load will come onto the system, and we need to serve that. What we've done to address that, because we are transmission providers, we are not in the generation resource determination, we've been working with Midwest ISO, independent power producers, the wind advocates, and anyone that has proposals, trying to identify possible locations of wind in anticipation of developing transmission infrastructure necessary to serve that load. We divided up the region into five different areas based on the geographic location of these various generation scenarios. We've identified three different studies that we're going to take a look at. One is a north and west bias, focusing on generation that is predominantly west of Minnesota as well as in the northern reaches of Minnesota. The black dots represent the potential locations of generation that we plan to incorporate in our study effort. There's also a Minnesota bias. The major difference here is you see a lot more dots in the metro area, representing a different change in scenario here, trying to focus more on generation and development within the state of Minnesota. Finally, we have an eastern bias. We have a problem in the operating system where a lot of flows tend to go west to east, and we're trying to see if a potential solution about putting generation east of here will, in fact, improve the transmission system so that we don't have to invest in additional transmission to bring generation below. What we're focusing on here is not the small transmission. We're looking at bulk transmission in our study effort. It's the backbone from which all the systems are operated from. We're looking at 345 solutions and higher, 500 being the maximum. What we've done here in the last couple of weeks is we've got these three different scenarios mathematically solved, and we've identified these types of conditions as they exist in anticipation of 6,300 megawatts of load growth in the various generation scenarios. System intact overload represents a condition from an operational standpoint that does not exist. Transmission system is never operated fully intact. So therefore, the overloads that you have identified in the column identified as system intact overloads represent a system that is not likely to happen, but it will happen. In fact, all the transmission were in place in the year 2020, and we had 42 different overloads. These types of overloads could cause cascading events, such as what occurred in August of 2002. What we do in the analysis and anticipation of planning is we look at the loss of a single facility and try to identify what transmission infrastructure is necessary to accommodate that loss of a particular facility. As you can see, there are well over 150 limiting facilities in this study area. And we're focusing on transmission that's 161 kV and above when we look at what type of facilities we're overloading. We're not addressing anything smaller than that at this time. We also have a requirement associated with our participation in the North American Electric Reliability Council, NERC, in mandating we maintain system reliability with regard to voltage violations. And we've identified several voltage violations in each of these base cases as well. You'll notice that within the Minnesota scenario, many of the limiters tend to be less, and that is because the generation is located closer to the load centers. What we've done is conceptually to define a map of what we anticipate are some of the scenarios that we're going to investigate. This is a conceptual map of transmission that we feel that we're going to look at that may address the problem in the year 2020. Our focus is bringing transmission into the generation centers and bringing it into the load center, as well as focusing on a transmission ring that's around the metro area, much that was done 30 to 40 years ago, the 345 loop that currently exists around the metro area. I'll turn it over to Mr. Shields.
Mr. Chairman, what we see as the critical issues currently is recognition of the viability and regional benefits in our need evaluation of the projects that we're considering. Certainty of investment recovery is just a key. If we're to make large capital investments, which these projects represent, there needs to be certainty that we're going to get a recovery on those investments. As leaders in our utilities, we have a fiduciary responsibility for the people that make investments in our utilities. Efficiency of the regulatory review process, we think, is important for projects to move along in a timely fashion. Siting, permitting, and rights of way are key elements of that. Also, there needs to be adjacent state coordination so that projects that cross the state borders can move forward in an efficient manner. And also, there will have to be some federal agency processes, too, where we all work in a collaborative fashion. One of the goals we have here today is we're trying to share information amongst ourselves as large transmission owners in Minnesota. We're trying to share information with all the different stakeholders, like yourselves, that are involved in this process. If everybody has the same information, this is one thing I learned early in my management career. If everybody has the same information, you typically come to the same conclusions. That's our goal here today. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present the work at the stage that we're in, and there'll be more to come in the months ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Shield, Mr. Pete. Any questions from the task force? Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, when he showed the map up there, the future lines and where they were going to go, the one that went to southwestern Minnesota, it looked like it was heading for the Iowa border, lickety-split, then all of a sudden takes off and heads for Minneapolis-St. Paul. Why was that?
What we see, we are trying to interface with the existing 345 transmission network that exists right now. And so what we're probably looking at here is tying two existing 345 kV substations, developing a loop network of transmission here for reliability.
Representative Western.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. Just early on, you said bottleneck or the issue or the problem area in the Red River Valley? Can you expand on that? Where exactly is that? And then 6,300 megawatts of new power online in the next 15 years, I believe you said. Is that Minnesota growth and consumption demand, or is that on the line to some of it's going to other states?
Okay, I'll answer the Red River Valley. What we're looking at is a voltage collapse situation in the Red River Valley. It's a result of load that continues to grow in that particular area and a lack of transmission and generation in that particular part of the state. What we're looking at is a transmission solution that brings additional source power into that area so that we can prop the voltage up in anticipation of continued load growth in that area.
What's the Fargo-Moorhead?
Fargo-Moorhead in particular. It also impacts the Alexander area as well and Bemidji.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, the 6,300 megawatts is represented by the utilities that serve customers in Minnesota and also includes their service areas in adjoining states, North and South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. So for these five large utilities that we talked about and other utilities that have service areas in Minnesota, it encompasses all of Minnesota and those adjoining areas that these utilities have service area in adjoining states.
We've not done that analysis. It's very difficult to identify when it comes to resource planning. They don't know where the load growth identify the bulk number. When it comes to doing simulation models that I participate in, trying to figure out where those boundaries are, it can be challenging. It's doable, but that's not the goal of this study.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this, I guess, could be addressed to either Mr. Peach or Mr. Scheel. Of the 6,300 megawatts, if you don't have the exact figure on this, just a rough estimate, how much, what's the percentage of it's hydro, coal, natural gas, wind? Do you have a rough estimate of that?
Our focus has not been on what generation resources are going to be needed to serve that load growth. We like to coin a phrase that we're the non-denominational transmission provider. I think that is a policy that the state has to address as to what kind of resources are necessary to serve that load.
But Mr. Chair, just quick. They're coming from certain areas. I mean, I see something heading up towards Manitoba and the Dakotas. I mean, do you have a... I mean, are there specific facilities that sound?
There are facilities that have been identified in the Midwest ISO queue of generation that is anticipated to be potentially developed here. What we did is we tried to create a cross hatch of generation, not paying any particular association to what kind of fuel source is going to drive that, with the exception that we do have a representative of about 2,300 megawatts of wind generation in each of the scenarios.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Peach, the lines that we see here in the conceptual transmission map, are those expansions of existing corridors? Are they new corridors? What are you talking about here?
Those are a combination of both. In many cases, they're new corridors. From an operations standpoint, I like to have variety in corridors when ice storms come through, so I don't have common right-of-way faults and outages. But most of these are new facilities. We're looking at possible investigation of 29 different transmission alternatives trying to address the overloads that we've identified thus far, most of which probably will not come to fruition, but we will try to find what we believe to be an optimal solution based on an exploratory study that we're conducting right now.
Would you name the other three members of your group besides Otterdale and Beard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it also includes Missouri River Energy Services, Xcel Energy, and Minnesota Power.
And one more. 3M had an interesting and fascinating press release this summer about a new cable technology they've come up with that allows us to reduce sag, reduce resistance at temperature. And I think I saw a fantastic number, like double capacity in the existing quarter. Did you hear that? And how's that coming? That's just the technical side of me that's fascinating.
I'm aware of what you're talking about. I'm not familiar with all the details associated with that. And what I gather from anecdotal discussions is a very costly solution.
Oh, I wondered. The price of wonder water. That's pretty fascinating. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simpson?
Mr. Chair, just a question. The 6,300 megawatts that you're talking about, what percentage increase is that overall we have now? Or what's the number we're running right now?
What we anticipate is about a 2.5% load growth over the next 15 years. We've done some studies looking back over the last 20 years. That load growth was looking at about 2.6%.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Arata?
One quick question. Out of the 6,300, how much of that is base load, or is that all considered base load or intermittent? Do you have a breakdown?
That is something that we haven't been trying to ascertain in our study. We're trying to focus on more of what transmission needs are associated with trying to serve that 6,300 megawatts of load.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we're going to have the Department of Commerce. We're going to have Commissioner Ed Garvey.
Is it good time to have a watch?
I think it is. It's 10 of 3. Yeah, 10 of almost 5 of 3.
Thank you.
Okay, I think everybody's got a copy of the handout. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Edward Garvey. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. I'm also made a couple of good task force to know that I served on the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission for about 5.5 years and was chair for 3 of those years. I have a quick handout that I think each of the members of the task force has now gotten. But I just want to walk through very, very quickly at least sort of page 2. It will probably engender a great number of questions because there's a lot of data and information behind each of these points that I wish to make. As Mr. Fuller already expressed to the task force very early, that we do have a guiding set of principles and that guide the department, that guide everything that we do, and I think to a large extent everything that you do as policymakers. Those guiding policies are reliability, low cost, and environmental superiority. I prefer the word environmental superiority than cleanliness, but certainly the sentiment is the same. Reliability, number one, cost second, environmentally superior the third, but all of these things are interwoven and you seek all to maximize all three as much as possible. Certainly, we have, and I think it would be worth noting that the department and the administration does have a 7-point, 8-point set of energy policies, of which renewable energy is a key component of. So when I sort of say that, I want to sort of make sure that from our perspective, renewable energy fits into a much larger context that we bring to bear when we think about energy and energy policy and the advocacy that we do before you, that we give you advice to apply to the authorities, as well as before the Public Utilities Commission. Renewable energy, especially wind, is a key component of that. It has been, is, and will become an increasingly important and valued Minnesota energy resource. We believe that Minnesota gets 11% of its electricity from renewable generating sources today. We believe that in a decade from now, by 2015, at least 20% of our state's electricity will come from renewable energy sources. This makes us, this makes our state one of the nation's leaders in electricity being produced and consumed from renewable energy sources. We support renewable energy for many reasons, but let me highlight two. There are significant environmental benefits from renewable energy sources. Currently today, we are avoiding over 5 million tons of greenhouse gases. Currently, we are avoiding 160 pounds of mercury. These environmental benefits, the avoidance of those kinds of pollutants and emissions, will double in the next decade, and on page 9, you'll see some of the data that backs that up. Another key component of our renewable energy policies is the development of what we're calling community-based energy development, or CBED, because of its benefits to our rural economies. As Mr. Fuller has already indicated, there are landowners receiving and will receive valuable income. Local governments receive valuable benefits, and there is certainly development of local jobs and industries. Renewable energy is a valued component of our energy resources. It will become an increasingly valued resource. Much of that success comes from the programs and policies that you as legislators and policymakers have developed in recent years that have provided financial support, the mandates, the renewable energy objectives, the research and development. They have been successful. They've expanded the state's renewable energy, renewable electricity, and are moving us into the 21st century. But there are two key components that I think we wish to pay attention to do that. We have inadequate transmission infrastructure, as you just heard from the folks at CapEx, and there are barriers to community-based energy development. We believe, the department believes, and we would sort of recommend that the way we can tackle the inadequate transmission infrastructure is by promoting investment, reducing regulatory barriers, and establishing better regional planning. And on page 4 are some ideas that may pique your interest. Dealing with the barriers to CBED, or community-based energy development, is to support transmission access for renewable resources and addressing the high front-end costs for community wind developers. Mr. Chairman, that's my very brief presentation. So let me reiterate, Minnesota values renewable energy. We get a large portion of our electricity from renewables today, and that percentage will grow significantly in the next decade. We're very pleased to be able to be one of the policy advocates to promote that, but there are two issues, the transmission infrastructure inadequacy and barriers to community-based energy development that I hope we can explore in the coming months. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation.
Well, thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Wilkinius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you do this presentation the next time, I think it would be helpful for us to know some context here. I mean, you say currently avoiding over 5 million tons of greenhouse gas. How do I? I mean, what's the context? Since there's no context, I don't have a sense of what this of meaning in here. The same thing with mercury. I don't have a sense of what this means because we don't have a context. And I hope, too, that in the future, you would talk about healthcare costs and do the same thing, avoiding how much in healthcare costs, because that is, I'm surprised we haven't dwelled on it as very much, but it's time we do. I mean, the studies are very, very clear out there now, and it would be helpful to have that information.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Rourke, for your testimony. On page 3, I found these charts very helpful, and I'm encouraged that you see the proportion of wind increasing from 11.4% to 48.8% and then on to 60.4% in the next 10 years, and the RDF going down, which concerns about that being counted as green. But or renewable. But I'm interested in the plan to get this increase in wind, which is substantial. You know, I think it looks great on a chart, but does the department have either a legislative agenda or a regulatory agenda to get these numbers up?
Chairman, we believe that this chart says two things. This chart says that the demand for electricity is going to be growing over the next decade for the state of Minnesota in general. We believe that the percentage of that electricity will be growing because a larger number of it will be devoted towards renewable generation. We believe that there are a number of policies already in place that are moving us in that direction right now. When I started talking about at least 20%, those policies that we have in place will get us there. And anything that we do between now and then will expand it. Now, what the point is that there are two issues, the barriers that may threaten the success of achieving that. And that's inadequate transmission and barriers to community-based energy development. And the policies that I think I'm urging the task force to think about is how to address those. We have the generation policies already in place. Now we need to make sure we can get the electrons delivered. If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiggins, I think you raised a helpful comment, and I appreciate that. I'll certainly take that contextual question in mind, but to the extent I can verbally address that now. On page 9, where we get our data, we're assuming that when the assumption is those are emission levels per megawatt hour from a traditional coal plant, that the electricity if we weren't getting our electricity from renewable sources, it would be generated from a coal plant. So that's the avoided context. So to the extent that I will bring that up and make that more clear in my next presentation, I will certainly do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. However, with the context that I think we need in order to, as we talk to our constituents and we talk to other Minnesotans, what is the total amount of greenhouse gases and what is this portion? I mean, you've told us about this portion, but you haven't told us about the context. So that's the stumbling block. You tell us about a hard number. It's not a percentage, and I have so it doesn't explain anything to me, and I don't think it explains anything to the rest of the consultants. And how about the healthcare cost? Is that something that you can help us out with?
Deputy Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, Representative Reyes. It's an issue that I'll explore with some experts that I may know.
You shouldn't have them on your staff.
Well, we're the Department of Commerce, not the Health Department. So, I mean, there are experts that we could probably draw on to some extent.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Representative Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick comments. One is, I appreciate the rosy picture you show us of renewables, but I just want to point out that I think all the definitions I've ever seen before used, including by your department, usually aren't quite so broad. And you're clear in here that you're using the broadest possible definition of renewables, but usually the definitions that we use are the ones that are based on the REO, and those show us at about 2% renewables rather than 11%, and I've never seen this 11% figure before from your department or anywhere else. So it's a different way of looking at things. So I just want to throw that out there so people understand. Depends on what you're defining as renewables. The other thing is, we keep hearing that transmission is a barrier for wind development, and I know that that's true. I'm not debating whether that's true or not, but I don't know. It seems to me, for example, when I hear about the new coal plant that's being proposed just across the border in Big Stone,
to serve the Minnesota load, and it's in southern, southwestern Minnesota that it'll serve the load primarily. No one's ever said there's a transmission barrier to building that coal plant, but it's in the same location. It'll be serving the same load as a lot of our where a lot of our wind development is taking place. So I don't know why we hear that when it comes to wind, but we don't hear that when it comes to any other kind of generation sources. So I think we need to be clear that it's a barrier for everyone, or it's a barrier. I mean, in some cases, sure, coal can be built near where the transmission is now, in more easily than wind or some other kinds of things that aren't movable. But that's an example of two kinds of generation sources that are being proposed for southwestern Minnesota. One is said to have a barrier of transmission, and one is not. So I think we just need to be fair in how we talk about that. And that's not just aimed at you, Commissioner Garvey, that's aimed at everyone who discusses this issue.
Mr. Chairman, if I may address two points that Chairman Anderson brings up. On page 13 is a listing of this state's definitions of renewable. We have, as it's sort of clear, that renewables and renewable definitions and what counts as a renewable is defined differently in a whole different set of sections in our own laws. So to some extent, that yes, it is sort of clear that in some settings, when you sort of look at only one statutory definition, it doesn't count certain generation types of fuels as renewable, while another does. Our goal was actually to sort of bring that issue forward, sort of say, when you look at all the definitions, they have brought a wide definition, we do have a large number of renewables already being used and consumed by Minnesotans. The second point on the transmission system, I think the important takeaway message from the CapEx presentation is that the entire grid is congested, and that any generation facility of any type has transmission constraints or would create transmission constraints. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to use a sort of a slang statement, a rising grid raises all electrons, and I think that's an important message to keep in mind. Because right, I think we need to do that. But I think the other factor to keep in mind when we think about wind per se is that in the traditional historic large generating facility context, it was a hub and spoke design. Large generation facility, couple wires taking it to load. Wind is by definition dispersed. And so therefore you have a different type of transmission set of issues than you have with a traditional larger scale, differently fueled generating facility. And that's actually one of the issues that we want to bring to the task force's attention is the accessibility of community-based energy development is one of those issues that we need to be thinking about when we think about the transmission grid. So thank you very much for that opportunity to address that question.
Okay. Representative Beard, or first, Representative Hornstein, were you finished with yours?
I'm done.
Okay. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey. After your presentation here, on the community-based energy development, page 2, we've got 3 bullet points here. Are these anecdotal, or do you have expertise in your department that can actually help us, as we talked about in an earlier discussion about what local development meant? Quantify if we're indeed driving it, or if we're, we have a conception that we are, but we're actually not. Let me know when you get there. After your question.
Yeah, no, I'm looking for a.
Page 3.
If, when you look at the numbers, and you see the growth, and you we're making a series of economic assumptions. Between 2003 last year and 2010, we'll have a 20%. We'll have a 94% growth in renewables, 20% growth in non-renewables. Between 2010 and 2015, we'll see a 29% growth on top of the 94% growth in renewables and a 5% growth in non-renewables. Between 2003 and 2015, we will see a 161% growth in renewables. All right, now when you translate that, and we tried to do some back-of-the-envelope analysis. This is not the kind of analysis. This is on the path that I think Mr. Fuller is trying to sort of walk us down, but it is very anecdotally. We believe that that would produce, you know, somewhere in the range of 3,359 jobs in the wind energy industry for the 2,089.6 megawatts that's anticipated. That the potential payments to landowners would be close to $6 million per year, $5,000 per year per turbine, for example, and that there would be roughly, $250 million of energy sales or more. I mean, to the point, those are just purely back of the envelope because we were trying to figure out that question. It was a set of assumptions that need to be tested. Challenged and certainly verified. It was in a response to an email that I asked my staff. Now, there are others that are experts in doing this kind of work that also sort of support this kind of analysis, but may not be supporting these kind of specific numbers. But the point is that, yes, this kind of energy does have local community development benefits.
Chair, just for our consideration and to my colleagues on this commission, perhaps this is something we do want to take up. If there's this thrust towards developing smaller projects, renewable projects in rural Minnesota, is there a better way to accomplish it? First of all, is it actually accomplishing it? Can we actually quantify the positive impact we're having? If it is there a difference between what we call small projects and large wind projects? Just so we don't inadvertently shoot ourselves in the foot with the best of intentions here. I think this would be, my submission to this group is, this would be something that would be worth us looking at.
Well,
I mean, just caution, though, as we do that, we need to take the entire state's economic impact into account so we don't fall into the business of exporting revenue from one area of the state and depositing it somewhere else. But I think it has merit in it. It's something we want to consider.
Good point, and it's number 5 on the agenda, and we might be discussing that here in a moment.
Okay.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, a way to, I think, to be helpful to frame it is that what we need to make sure that these are, that we need to make sure that there are structural, that there, that the structural barriers and structural components are designed in a way to promote this, and then so then you sort of let the resources and the entrepreneurs that want to tap those resources work it out, and that's how you sort of work it out. I mean, I think that there's a very delicate balance that needs to be made between sort of the micro specific kinds of things and the larger scale. I mean, I think we need to always keep in mind, as Representative Peter talked about it, that at the state level, we need to be thinking about the reliability, the cost, and environmental superiority. We want to make sure there's no structural barriers to the types of generating technologies that can promote those and meet those standards.
Senator Dill?
Well, I just wanted to say that the last power line that we built 25 years ago didn't hit my farm. It missed it by 200 yards. And I wish it would have hit it, because each tower had 4 legs on it, and each leg was worth almost $4,000. I think it was $4,000. My neighbor was lucky enough to get the tower to hit his farm, and he used that money to build a new machine shed. So anyway, I regret that I didn't cash in on that money at that time. Now, the second thing I wanted to say is that I've been a longtime anti-smoker and interested in promoting all kinds of legislation that would discourage people from smoking. But I've been affected by that memo we got in the last few days from this retired environmental consultant that went through the research to support the notion that secondhand smoke kills people because of the carcinogenicity of the chemicals in that secondhand smoke. And I was stunned by what he had to say. And I don't know if he's right or wrong, but if he's right, that argument that we should ban smoking everywhere and so on because it causes cancer is probably not a correct argument. Now, there's other arguments you can make, maybe because of allergies and other disease problems associated with it. But getting back to what Representative Wagini is concerned about with the environmental aspect of coal-burning plants and so forth, it just crossed my mind that if this environmental consultant is right about secondhand smoke, maybe the so-called experts in society at large is wrong about how bad these coal-burning plants are, and maybe we don't have so many sick people out there because of them. So, Mr. Garvey, when you check on this, would you make sure you're checking in a way that is looking at peer-reviewed research and that, you know, we've got it all figured out right, and it's not a notion that is not, you know, the notion in society is that secondhand smoke kills you and you get cancer from it. And I want to know where the truth lies. I'm not sure if that's true, but at least I question it now. And I want you to, you know, question that as well, and let's find out where the truth really lies.
Well, Senator Dill, you opened up a bag of worms here. I was hoping to be able to get out of here. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Alston. This study that is a big one was done by Harvard about 4 years ago, published, at least a summary of it was published by the PCA, was peer-reviewed, and it did figure out the health care costs of fine particulate matter, and that's the thing that you're interested in. Those costs were done nationally, but some folks have taken the cost, that big national number, and brought it down to power plants like the one in Minneapolis. And if I, on my number, maybe off about 2 million, but I believe that the fine particulate cost that we're paying right now from that coal-fired power plant in Minneapolis is $56 million a year. And thus, my constituents are paying that as taxpayers, and they're paying it as on their health insurance. These are big numbers. I was shocked to see that kind of number. And obviously, the governments know about this. It was part of the Merck record. These health care costs were part of the Merck record. But it doesn't seem like we have brought them forward in this document, for example. And I think it's just time
we do, and
that is the document, and I hope we can all become very familiar with that, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else, Commissioner Garvey?
Not unless the members wish me to go through some of the ideas that I have on pages 2 and 5, which are some of the ideas, but I know you're short on time, so you're welcome to read them and if you have questions on this.
Any other questions from task force members? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you,
Doug. Okay, at this time, well, first of all, I would like to thank everybody that came to testify and enlighten us. Thank you very much. And also, Mr. John Fuller from Senate Council and Research, you did a wonderful job. Thank you very much. And Mr. Bob Eloff from House Research, thank you. You did a wonderful job on your presentation.
I'll have to really
thank you very much. With that, also, we have some technical things to take care of. Minutes from April 20th. Our last meeting that we had was in May, but we didn't have a quorum at that time for that. So we're going to Representative Gunther, did you take a look at the minutes? Representative Gunther moves the minutes from April 20th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Okay, with that, we also have in our packets here a letter from Mr. Tim Henning. We had a number of people that wanted to testify today, but we had a limited amount of time, and we had a schedule that we were going to stick to, so those folks were not allowed to speak today, but I wanted to mention the letter from Mr. Tim Henning. He called me at my home, and we allowed him to give written testimony today. So you can take a look at that. And yep, all the number of us, I think. And also, number 5 on the agenda, do we want to talk about any further discussion on the future work of this task force? I think we're going to be taking a look at the work group report, and that'll be after January 15th, and I think we should have a meeting at that time to look at that report, if that's all right, Senator Metzen. And I think that should be our next meeting if there's no objection to that, and we'll probably schedule something when we see the report come in. Sometimes these reports aren't always on time. Representative Westman.
Maybe council can help review my memory, but as I remember, is that report going to be to the LETF?
No.
Or is that
to the legislature?
Legislature.
Yes.
Okay, because the LETF, I believe, is supposed to submit the report to the,
correct,
to the legislature.
But we'd like to look at what the work group put together, Representative Westman. Okay.
But that's going to be the LETF's report.
Correct. That's correct. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, just if I can just reiterate my suggestion, it doesn't have to be solved today, but let's ponder it over the next couple of months. As we're with the best of intentions and putting everything we have into this whole adventure of encouraging other development, distributed generation, community-based generation, so on and so forth, I think some of us do it with some emotion, I'm sure, is attached to it. But I encourage us to ask for facts and to actually examine, contemplate whether our desired outcomes are actually happening. Is this reality that we're dealing with, or is it just an expectation or fond hope that we have? And if there's a way we could get our arms around whether or not a small wind project on somebody's farm has as much economic impact to the state of Minnesota or to that individual landowner as, say, a larger conglomeration, a bigger conglomeration to put together. There's all kinds of nuances in this and the way it affects people. And we're going to have to pick and choose one way or the other. But let's do it at least with evidence that we can have faith in and confidence in. The other one I suggest is many of us weren't here when this health report that puts this fantastic number on fine particulate matter from power plants was presented. And so I think there's an expectation that we would just accept this at face value. Many of us don't. I'm going to math in my head about, good Lord, how many coal fired burners are there in this state? And this must be a number that's in the billions then that somebody's paying for health problems. Maybe that is the case. I'm willing to stand corrected. It might be beneficial for us to have sometime somebody from PCA or the Department of Health, whoever is carrying the data on this, that we can poke and prod at and come to a conclusion whether this is a credible number we can have with confidence or whether it's not, or whatever. The truth will have us out, and I'm just advocating in favor of research and policy.
Well, Representative Beard, on your second point, I think that would be a good discussion for another one of our task force meetings in the near future. But as a whole, I think we need to look at our energy policy for the state of Minnesota. We're not going to be able to do it in a couple of meetings, especially during the legislative session. I think we're going to have to meet in the interim and discuss this issue on a broader scale. And maybe this summer we can start discussing that and have some more meetings about what our energy policy is going to be if we need to readdress it. Any other discussion? With that, meeting adjourned.
Good work. Good work.
We're out of here.